Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. My name is Saif Ahmad. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a significant impact on the care of cancer patients around the globe. In today's podcast, we speak with Dr. Tom Rogues and Dr. Pippa Lewis about an important initiative set up by the Royal College of Radiologists to help manage this disruption, the RCR repository. At the RCR, Dr. Tom Rogues is Medical Director for Professional Practice in Clinical Oncology, and Dr. Pippa Lewis is a Senior Clinical Oncology Trainee, currently working as the NHS England National Radiotherapy Fellow. So Tom and Pippa, thanks so much for joining us today. I wanted to start off by asking quite a general question, really. What would you say are some of the main challenges that COVID-19 now presents to cancer patients and their treatment?
I think there's probably three main areas. Firstly, the fact that many anti-cancer treatments, at least in theory, can suppress your immune system and might make you more prone to a more severe COVID infection. That was certainly a big concern at the start of this, when we didn't really know how the virus would behave and how it would behave in different people. So that really changed our assessment of the risk and benefit for individual people. I think the second thing is that hospitals have been extremely busy to different degrees up and down the country and throughout the world, dealing with and focusing on COVID. And part of that, as we all know, has been social distancing. And for radiotherapy, we're asking people to come to treatment for 20, 30 times to a hospital. And so working in departments to make those visits as safe as possible for patients and for staff who are still working and still carrying out treatments has been a major challenge, and that's going to be with us for a long time as the pandemic becomes endemic, and it's going to change over time depending on what the risks are. And then I think the third challenge, and it's probably the most important one, is the differences in the diagnostic and treatment pathways that suddenly having a new serious disease has thrown up. So we know that the urgent referrals for suspected cancer have been reduced to 25% of their normal levels just before Easter. They're now coming up a little bit, but that means that people are not being diagnosed as frequently. There may be delayed diagnoses and therefore different treatment options. And in terms of treatment, whilst radiotherapy and chemotherapy have continued relatively normally for a large number of patients, with the exception of making sure that we're extra safe and weighing up those risks that I talked about before, surgery has largely stopped for a period of time and is now restarting, and coping with losing one cancer treatment modality for 2 months is a major, major challenge for the healthcare system.
Thanks for talking that through. So clearly a lot of challenges on that front. And that brings me to the article that the two of you have written for the Clinical Oncology Journal, which details very well the approach that the RCR has taken to help guide us through this. So can you tell us a bit about that article and specifically about the RCR guidance repository that you detail?
So in response really to the pandemic, and when we saw that obviously oncology services were going to have to react quite rapidly and potentially change practice in response to the pandemic and those risks that our patients potentially faced, we noticed just general activity between clinical oncologists on our site, tumour site specific fora on the clinical oncology, on the RCR's website. People just generally sort of swapping ideas and giving each other advice about best practice. So there was a bit more activity happening on those fora, and the RCR then opened a specific COVID-19 forum for people to exchange ideas and advice. Obviously, we noticed people doing similar things on social media, particularly on Twitter. And so the college decided that it would be a good idea to provide a sort of a place where we could bring all of those ideas and advisory recommendations together. So we set up this repository, which is really a sort of an online virtual library where people could send us advisory documents that they've pulled together, just with advice which is tumor site specific about chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and general management of patients during the COVID-19 pandemic. And it became a source of advice really for not just for Royal College fellows and members, but open to all doctors, physicians, clinicians, and allied health professionals working in oncology to access sort of up-to-date and frequently reviewed advice from experts in the field.
Thanks so much for detailing that. And I think it's really important that it's open to all. I think that people can access it in that way. I mean, I've been on the website and seen just how many things it covers, actually. Do you have any sort of feedback on who's been using it? Has it mostly been clinicians or sort of service leaders? Or, you know, how has it been used so far and the kind of feedback that you've had so far?
I think the informal feedback has been excellent. We know that the documents have been downloaded individually more than 21,000 times, which is, I think, far more than any other college set of documents has ever been downloaded. So presumably someone is finding them very useful. I've seen them referenced in sort of online discussions in America and Australia and other places. So I think they are getting far and wide. And that point you make about having them accessible was key. I think that, you know, a key role of a body like the Royal College is to connect people and to allow that exchange of ideas. And the oncology community has been fantastic at producing these things very quickly, at wanting to share knowledge and advice. And we've just tried to make that as easy as possible, really. So I suspect it's a variety of clinicians, trainees, radiographers, physicists, hopefully not just from the UK, but from different countries in the world as well.
Yeah, so I just wanted to add to that we had got guidance written for all tumour sites. We've actually got 26 documents in the repository at the moment. And as a result of that, we've had queries and communications from clinicians. As Tom mentioned, in Australia, in Slovenia, we've had doctors from all around the world, obviously reading our guidance, going to the website, reading the guidance and contacting us. So we know that actually they've reached some quite far corners of the world and hopefully been useful to clinicians, not just in the UK.
That's fantastic. And having helped to compile this data set, as it were, and clearly it covers a number of broad areas, do you feel there are any headline or emerging themes that or messages that people can take away sort of listening to this podcast? Clearly we'd advise everybody to go on the repository to access the source material.
I mean, I think we tried right from the start not to be prescriptive in how these documents were written. We wanted to be the place where ideas could be shared, and so we didn't say, here's the template, write your guideline according to these sections. We said, write it as best you can, and we'll do our best to share it and keep it up to date. We have right from the start tried to have a way to update them regularly, and at the minute we're just going through quite a big refresh because we're sort of entering what people are calling the recovery phase and trying to get to a new normal. We've tried to have named authors on there so that people again can email and interact with those authors separately offline. In terms of the headline things, I think that almost the kind of catalyst at the start was the breast cancer guidance driven by the Fast Forward trial, because that was a new clinical trial that we were expecting to report and be published in the very near future anyway, had it not been for COVID. But suddenly there was a real stimulus to get hypofractionation in quickly, because it would mean fewer visits for patients and less exposure to COVID. So that was one of the first documents. And I think, you know, practice in breast cancer has been changed more quickly than at any other time ever, I suspect, by doing that. So that was a very good way of immediately engaging the breast cancer community. And Pippa mentioned the RCR message boards. I think as a college, it's been difficult sometimes to know how we best facilitate that discussion in a time where you've got to be careful of data protection and things, and you can't just email everybody out with ideas. But the discussion boards have been excellent in promoting that engagement and discussion. And over the course of 24 hours, it became very clear that it would be quite straightforward to publish the protocol of the Fast Forward trial and to get that out into clinical practice. So that was probably the initial prototype that worked best. And the others have been a variety, really. So the upper GI HPB group had a very active WhatsApp group who'd already produced guidance and needed a home because they didn't have a website for it. The thyroid guidance was one line, don't give any radioactive iodine for the moment. So that was nice and easy to do. The head and neck one, we happened to have a college head and neck meeting the week before lockdown. And we sat in that meeting and changed the order of the meeting, just have a half an hour discussion about the kind of things we would write in a head and neck document. So they've all grown up in slightly different ways. The lung document is a very evidence-based, robustly produced, detailed document. So they all have their own characters, which I think it was actually quite important for us not to be too prescriptive.
Yeah, I also wanted to add, I think one of the important things to say is that a lot of the groups who developed these guidance documents referenced the three key documents that have come out: the NHS England specialty guide for management of patients requiring cancer treatment, and also the NICE rapid guidelines for radiotherapy delivery and for systemic anti-cancer therapy. Those three documents were all released within 2 weeks of each other in mid-March. And many of the groups that wrote their advisory documents referenced those. They're particularly helpful, really, because they just help clinicians sort of frame their COVID-19 specific advice around the sort of prioritisation structures for cancer patients that have been nationally agreed by NHS England and also referenced by NICE. So I think each group did that individually. They all referenced those documents individually, but I think it's helpful for people who are going to the repository and looking at these tumour site specific documents to also know that the other three general guidance documents are out there and openly available.
Yeah, I think that's quite an important point, isn't it? Because there was a risk, I think there still is a risk, that everybody wants to produce a guidance document on this, and that there's overlap and slightly different guidance from different people, and that's never a particularly helpful situation. And the fact that NICE in particular were able to produce guidance very quickly, that actually both Pippa and I were involved with on the therapy side, does enable it to all kind of hold together, which I think is good. And it's good looking back at something like the NICE guidance, which was written 6 weeks ago now, which is quite a long time in the current situation, but it still provides a good set of principles as to how to change practice.
Thanks so much for that. So you've already alluded to some of the challenges of bringing such a piece of work together. Having gone through this, what did you see as some of the real challenges and hurdles that you had to overcome?
Obviously, there was lots of enthusiasm amongst clinicians to provide these documents, which was fantastic. So I suppose the initial challenge with getting it all together was just managing all of the different groups of people. And some groups of authors went away and wrote their documents and came back with the final version. With others, there was a bit more sort of thrashing out via email of what the final wording ought to be. So that took a bit of time and work. Once we had all of the documents uploaded and we were happy with the final versions, the challenge really then was just ensuring that they're kept up to date and regularly reviewed. We know that all of the people that were writing these documents were also busy in clinical practice and having to deal with potentially being redeployed to COVID wards or losing junior staff. And so on top of their clinical workload in these very unusual and unprecedented times, we were wary of overloading them with too many emails asking them to constantly review and update their guidance. But everybody worked very well together, and actually everybody's been very responsive and has kept the documents up to date, which has been fantastic. Obviously, once the documents are out there and people are downloading them and using them, there's obviously going to be feedback, and lots of people may have differences of opinion or may not think that their practice aligns with the advice in the document. And so it's been a challenge to try and incorporate the feedback of other clinicians as well. Equally, some people have been publishing their response to the COVID pandemic for their particular tumour type in journals, and, you know, nationally and internationally. And sometimes those publications have not necessarily been aligned with perhaps the advice that's in some of the guidance documents in our repository. So I suppose that's really been the greatest challenge, is just trying to ensure that everything is very responsive, that the advice that we're giving can be regularly updated, that we're incorporating feedback, and that we make sure that we're not sending conflicting messages.
So you raised, I mean, that was a really good point about something maybe published and it may not fully align with what you've already got out there in the repository. So then how do you handle that then?
I mean, mostly I think there's been ongoing discussion between between specialists and experts, whether that's via the ongoing use of the Clinical Oncology Fora on the RCR website or via social media or just with personal communication between experts in that field. I think what has been interesting to note, though, is that whilst there may have been some small differences of opinion, in general, most people's opinions have aligned. There hasn't, to my knowledge, been any huge differences of opinion. Most people's advice is generally in line. It's just sort of perhaps small details that may be different.
And I think also really important to make the point that the documents are, I mean, they're going to be flexible in the sense that the risks change as the pandemic changes, as people's ability to work normally changes. And so I don't think any of them are so didactic that they tell you what you have to do all the time. These are guidance that need interpreting in the current context. I think what makes them really good for the UK oncology community is that they are written by UK clinical oncologists. I think sometimes when international guidance documents like those from ESTRO and ASTRO combined try to incorporate many different views, they can end up slightly watering down the message.
Thanks so much for that. And you've already alluded to the recovery and the fact that we're going to be having to adapt to new normals as things change and evolve. How are you going to approach that from the point of view of the repository?
As we said, we've been trying to sort of regularly review and update the advisory documents as the weeks go by, because things are changing very rapidly. And most recently, we contacted all of the authors of the documents that we've got published and asked them to do a bit of an update, specifically including just a couple of comments or a couple of lines on what they feel the focus of restoration of normal service in their particular tumour site ought to be, or how they think that could be best achieved. So that was our first step, really, was just trying to gauge the opinion of these expert authors in how they felt they might be able to start resuming normal service again. And then we've included that in the most up-to-date documents that are available currently.
That's right. The other thing the college is just trying to do is to pull together a sort of overarching document about recovery and restoration with general principles. But I think actually, compared to many areas of medicine, radiotherapy and chemotherapy have kept going. And we, you know, quite early on got used to screening patients with questions when they came to the department and taking their temperature and wearing PPE. And I think we've been trying to keep going. So there's perhaps less restoration needed than there is in some parts of medicine at the moment.
Thanks so much for that. And in your articles, you detailed some really important research initiatives that are going on at sort of national and other levels as well. Presumably they will help very much with defining some of the recovery strategies. Would you like to just briefly mention some of these and why they're particularly important?
So there are many, and I think it's interesting to reflect on the fact that initially, everybody wanted to write guidance documents, and now they all want to write research protocols because we all want to know what's happening. I think a lot of departments have collected what have been called harm review templates, which are ways of collating information on how treatment is changed because of COVID-19. So are you giving different doses of radiation? Are you doing radiation as opposed to surgery? How are you modifying what you're doing? And there's a plan from CTRAD to collate that data nationally so that we can look at it across the patch, which will be helpful. There's the UK Coronavirus Cancer Monitoring Project, which is looking at collecting data on every cancer or on every cancer patient, if possible, who is COVID-19 positive, to try to tease out what the risk factors and their outcomes might be. I know that there are also sub-projects of the main national database on all COVID patients, looking at the cancer risk factors within that. There are individual tumour pathway projects, you know, how does head and neck cancer, how does gynae cancer change in response to COVID-19. So there's almost the point where there are so many projects going on, it's difficult to know quite where to look. But I think the two that I'd start with are the UK Coronavirus Cancer Monitoring Project run by Birmingham and the CT RAD data collection project, because they quickly will enable us to get a handle on what's happening right across the country.
Thanks so much for that. And just towards the end of the discussion, I just wanted to reflect on the fact that this repository that you've been able to put together has clearly been, you know, really impactful and helpful. Just your experience, both as being involved with this project, but being clinicians and involved with cancer during this time. What have been your thoughts around this? I mean, it's a bit of a leading question, but I mean, this seems like a very positive project. What would you see as some of the positive outcomes, in a sense, of the cancer community facing up to the threats faced by the pandemic?
I think for me, the thing that has stood out has been the absolute enthusiasm and motivation of all the oncology workforce that we've dealt with in setting up this repository. As I mentioned before, the workloads have been heavy. There's been unprecedented challenges in providing cancer care for patients in the past couple of months while the pandemic has been evolving, and everybody that we've been in contact with who's helped contribute to this repository of guidance documents has done so quickly and helpfully and in a really positive way. And it's been a really great experience to work with everybody who's managed to stay very positive and also to react and work quite quickly. And it's just shown really that actually when there's a common goal and, you know, we're all trying to work for good, actually things can happen very quickly. And that's been really encouraging to see.
Yeah, I completely echo that. And I think the other thing just to reflect on is the fact that even with good modern technology that we had before all of this, it's quite easy to get a bit siloed and to just work in your own department and not really know what's happening on the ground elsewhere. And you can read the research papers, but that's not quite the same as really talking and being reassured that everybody else is struggling with the same issues and problems as you are. And I think this has been a fantastic way, just to, as Pippa said, to bring the community together, not to give answers, because we haven't got all the answers, but to at least share the uncertainties. And I think we're looking at, you know, every way we can within the college of building on that, and building on our role of networking and enabling people to work more closely together. Because I think most of us feel enabled by good, well-written guidance rather than hampered by it. There might have been a time 20 years ago when doctors felt a bit nervous about guidance and wanted to do our own thing. I think that's not the case at all at the moment. I think everybody's very open-minded about having some kind of, you know, expert central advice on how to do things. You don't need to take it necessarily, but I think having that and having the ability to produce things that are relevant in the moment, able to be updated quickly, is really valuable.
Thanks so much for that. And thanks so much for taking the time to speak to us today. Really appreciated.
Thanks, Seth.
Thank you. And it's important to mention and say thank you to the college staff who've been involved in getting the document library up and running. They've worked very hard on it with us.